Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's political podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast and I'm now joined by James Forsyth, our political editor, and Katie Balls, our political correspondent. So James, there's news this morning that Corbyn attended this event organised by Judas, which is a left-wing Jewish group who've been quite critical of various other Jewish organisations. Do you think that was a wise move by the Labour leader?
I think it was an unwise move, because this group have been very dismissive of the idea that there is an anti-Semitism problem in Labour. They've claimed that those people saying there is are doing the work of the Tory party or the Labour right. So to go to their event in the current circumstances rather undercuts Jeremy Corbyn's claim that he's taking this whole anti-Semitism scandal seriously.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just a very curious and slightly bewildering decision to go to that event. Some people have been quick to point out, he attended a Jewish event with a Jewish community, and actually perhaps it's just the mainstream media being really picky. You know, you can't say he's anti-Semitic for doing this, and you can't also dictate which Jewish communities are acceptable and which aren't. But I think the issue isn't that he's meeting different parts of the community. It's just very, very curious that after, you know, weeks of these allegations, and after the Board of Deputies was partly behind that demonstration on Monday in Parliament Square, that he would choose this group's event to attend, because this group has a blog post up where they basically suggested that the people behind that demonstration were using it just to make things difficult for Jeremy Corbyn while having valid concerns. It's a group that's also suggested that Israel needs to kind of be destroyed. And I think there's lots of things like that, which mean because that is the clearest action or the event he chose to go to, it just seems that loggerheads with the comments he is making, saying that he is taking these allegations really seriously. And I think that is what's tricky here. It's not saying, oh, you can't meet with certain communities.
I think Katie's right, is that the choice to prioritise meeting this group does make it much more difficult to say that he's taking this whole issue seriously. I thought it was very telling that John Landsman, the leader of Momentum, was saying that, this was Jeremy Corbyn's night off and his office didn't know he was going, which seemed to imply that if they had known he was going, they might have told him it wasn't such a good idea.
Momentum yesterday said that anti-Semitism was actually more of a problem than they had initially thought, and the accusations should not be dismissed as right-wing smears. Do you think the party are starting to take it a bit more seriously?
I think there are lots of people in the Labour movement who are beginning to realise that this is a serious problem, that you can't just say that this is being got up by Jeremy Corbyn's political opponents. I mean, the big question now is whether Corbyn is prepared to act decisively in a way to try and kind of rid the Labour Party of this virus. And I mean, the problem is, for him, the political challenge is doing that would involve expelling a lot of people from the Labour Party who probably joined quite recently and joined to support him.
And there was a really interesting poll at the weekend, a Times YouGov poll, which looked at what Labour members think about the way, you know, these allegations are coming out, the way Jeremy Corbyn is handling them. That was before the event he attended on Sunday. But nearly 8 out of 10 Labour members think that claims of anti-Semitism have been exaggerated or are being used to stop legitimate criticism of Israel or to damage Jeremy Corbyn. And I think that shows you too that actually the Labour base is probably with Corbyn on this.
James, the other story today is Michael Gove announcing a tightening up on the sale of ivory in the UK. What do you make of that?
Oh, I think there are two things behind this. One is that the Tories conspicuously didn't include this in their manifesto at the last election. They had this quite broad exemption for antiques, and it definitely cost them votes. You know, it's one of those animal stories that went viral on social media. So I think there's that on the one hand. I mean, the other thing is, this is all part of the thing that Katie has written about before, which is this Tory attempt to kind of seize the environmental agenda. You see this with kind of Michael Gove is kind of coming up with new things at DEFRA on a kind of regular basis, and I think they think that leading the world on this ivory ban enables them to go to this wildlife conference in London in October, at which, you know, the royal family will be present and all sorts of things like that, and really push for tougher global action. And for the Tory party to say, look, we are the party that is protecting the environment, that is doing all of these things. And I think it is a remarkable kind of story of how a kind of energetic cabinet minister can take a kind of backwater department and turn it into one of the most dynamic in Whitehall.
And Katie, do you think younger voters are going to be convinced by the Tories becoming this new party of green conservatism?
I'm not sure they're seeing them as a party of green conservatism, but I think it's getting harder for them to dismiss it as a party of climate change deniers and a party that doesn't care about the environment, which I think you've got to think of things relative. Maybe that's probably as good as they can get with some voters. And I think in terms of what Michael Gove is doing there, actually, although it is very impressive what he's done in this department, part of the reason he's managed to be quite radical is lots of these green measures are things that are quite popular. And they're also small enough for in terms of cost that it's not that difficult for the government to do these things. And A, it helps the environment, too, probably helps their voting in a way that, although we're now hearing with the NHS we might get more funding, it's much harder for a minister to go into that and shake up the whole system. Some of the stuff you hear and you're a bit like, why don't we have that already? I think if you look at kind of all polls, the environment is the issue most young voters are really concerned about. So it's definitely worth doing this. And I think it makes it harder for Labour to attack or depict them as a party of people like Nigel Lawson, who still, to be fair, do question climate change.
But I think there's a public acceptance of these measures. I think it's quite striking that this bottle deposit return scheme that Gove announced the other week, which will be, frankly, be a faff for most consumers. You know, that has 74% support. I think people do like practical environmentalism, things that they feel that they can do. I mean, part of the problem with climate change is it's such a kind of big question. You know, it's hard to believe that kind of any one individual's actions are actually going to have much of an effect. And you can make an argument that whatever the UK does on climate change is dwarfed in importance by how China behaves. But some of these smaller, more kind of micro measures, I think they feel more tangible to people.
And Katie, have there been any developments in the blue passport saga?
Yep, so blue passports appear to be, in terms of just Brexit, seem to be the Simba that managed to get the most people annoyed of any single group on both sides of the debate. But the latest on blue passports is the British company that lost out on the contract to make the blue passports to Dutch/French company. They are now appealing the decision, and the reason they lost out on that bid was because theirs was more expensive, so the government went for the lower cost bid, which should in theory save the taxpayer money. It's been quite interesting because that opened up like a schism in the Brexit camp. So you have the people more on the protectionist side, and the Daily Mail are leading the charge here, saying this should go to a British business. Then you have the pro-free trade side, the Sun is on that side, saying come off it, you know, the whole point is about opening markets, we shouldn't begrudge another company getting if it's better value for the taxpayer. At the moment it's hard to see if they will really win this appeal, but I do think a few people in government have been slightly made nervous by the reaction of, you know, why doesn't a British company get it. Personally, I think it'd probably be a mistake to change it on that, unless, as this company alleges, that theirs is a much more safe or high quality thing, and that's what the country needs.
James, is this just an example of the sort of thing we're going to have to get used to in our post-Brexit world, this kind of free market versus protectionist debate?
Yeah, I think Katie's right. And one of the things that this whole row has highlighted is the kind of Brexit coalition brought together, the Leave vote brought together two quite separate groups. One is the kind of buccaneering, free trading, open to the world. You know, their big issue, one of their issues with the EU was that it's a kind of regional bloc in a global world that, you know, that has these kind of the customs union prevented Britain from doing its own trade deals with other countries. You know, all of that kind of, you know, that sums up, I suppose, by that Spectator front cover saying kind of out and into the world on the one hand. And then you had this other group of voters who back Brexit, who kind of want more protection, who think that, you know, national governments should be resisting globalisation more. And this is what this whole blue passport debate has summed up, you know, which is the free traders, I think, are incredibly relaxed about which company makes the passport. You know, their argument is, you know, let's just get the best deal for the taxpayer. While as those on the more protectionist side are like, we should have these passports made in Britain to try and protect British jobs. I personally think that De La Rue, the British firm involved in this, are being slightly disingenuous in that they have contracts with 40 other countries to make their passports or banknotes or documents. And so if we're going to get into a situation where you have to be from the country to make the country's passport, that isn't going to benefit De La Rue either.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. And just a reminder that this podcast is called Coffee House Shots. You can subscribe on the iTunes store. And if you want to subscribe to the magazine, we've got a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues for just £12, as well as one of those lovely moleskin notebooks, if you go to spectator.co.uk/pod offer. Thank you for listening.